Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. As our planetary system seems to be crashing these days, our Pathways show today is going to focus on the environment. Our guest is Mark Sheehan of the Shaka Foundation and Maui Tomorrow, two nonprofits that are fighting for the future of the island of Maui, and indeed for all of us. Mark has lived in Hawaii for 45 years, has been an educator, real estate broker, and environmental activist. He has served on the board of Maui Tomorrow for 25 years. Maui Tomorrow's mission is protecting Maui's future by serving as an environmental advocacy organization, as a watchdog for enforcement of Hawaii's environmental and land use laws. For the past 4 years, Mark has also been a guiding force in the Shaka movement and the effort to educate the public on the dangers of GMOs and to curb the abuses of industrial / chemical agriculture, with a focus on Maui, but with relevance to environmentally aware citizens everywhere. Hello, Mark, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hello, Paul. Nice to be here.
All right. Well, let's start out with some history. Maui Tomorrow. How did it start, and what has it done?
About 30 years ago, there was a battle to protect a beach called McKenna Beach, a rather famous beach, one of the more beautiful beaches in the world. And as that went on, we began to realize, rather than having single issues, we should form an organization that really looked at Maui's future, because we could see there was a development juggernaut that was going on and without really good planning. So we thought, well, we really need to have smart growth. And Maui Tomorrow was a way of looking at planning and development and creating a vehicle so that citizens could agitate for smarter growth and slow down the development apparatus until the infrastructure could develop concurrently with it. Generally, we have a process where development gets way ahead of the infrastructure, and then we have crowding, we have clogged highways, we have a shortage of schools, fire and police forces, and so on. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to really have development controlled in a way.
Now, this is a tough problem on Maui, because right now I think Maui's got a population of 160,000 permanent residents, but at any given time it's got how many tourists?
40,000 tourists.
40,000?
Right.
On average?
And it's really, like other islands, we were a small islands of small towns, and so there isn't the roads, there isn't the facilities for handling the growth. We are over capacity. In fact, there's a discussion now of over tourism, where we don't have any control over the airlines and the number of seats that they book, but we do have some ability to control the rate at which we approve hotel rooms. And on an island like Maui, where we have accommodations for 15 to 20,000 people, we very easily in high season get to the point where we have a kind of gridlock around our small towns. You notice it in the North Shore when you wind up waiting in line for 20 or 25 minutes to get through small towns like Paia.
Right, I've noticed that. I go to Maui a couple times a year and the traffic's horrific. So it's obvious that infrastructure is needed, but it's the infrastructure and the need for it is driven by developers, or has been driven by inexorable development.
That's right.
And the developers are a tiny fraction of the population.
Right, but they have an outside influence because of their ability to persuade, cajole, and finance campaigns of candidates. So the majority of the county council, it's a 9-person member council, is pro-tourism, pro-development. And for that reason, we ran some of the progressive people ran a slate of candidates that were people's candidates in the last election, and we got four candidates elected. They are.
Is that a Maui Tomorrow project?
That was not a Maui Tomorrow project. There was an organization called SAFE, the Sustainable Action Fund for the Environment, that promoted these candidates. They were able to do it because it was a nonprofit that had the ability to form a political action committee and to support these people's candidates as opposed to the development candidates.
Now I want to move on to talk about the Shaka movement, but before I do, just one last question about Maui Tomorrow. What success stories have come out of the last 25, 30 years?
Oh, that's a long explanation.
What's a couple of them?
Well, recently we had a major settlement with a developer for in the McKenna area that owns 1,754 acres. And that settlement, which was unprecedented, allowed for the developers to build affordable housing within the project, to preserve dozens of cultural sites, to allow for walking trails, to minimize impacts at the near the ocean, to reduce the size and number of condominiums that they were proposing to develop, and to limit the entire build out of the project to 1,100 units instead of 4,000.
Now, when you say housing for, what did you call it? Affordable housing?
Affordable housing.
That, I've been to McKenna, and it's a beautiful part of the island, and the only people that own land there, as far as I can tell, are very wealthy. Oprah's got a place there, there's other people like that there, other celebrities, and it's just on the other side of Wailea, which is like the Beverly Hills of Hawaii. It's hard to imagine tucking affordable housing into that section of the island.
It's hard to understand given the big splashy mansions that are being built down there that the local people lived there for decades. It was a part of the island that nobody wanted to go to. When I first arrived in 1970, the paved road ended as in the middle of Kihei, and McKenna was another 10 miles further out.
Well, there was no water there.
There was
in 1970.
Very limited water, and it was just undeveloped. And then it got discovered by with the build out of Wailea and McKenna, and many years ago, 45 years ago, I'm guessing, the Cebu Railway Corporation bought 1,800 acres from one of the large ranches over there, the Ulupalakua Ranch, and with the goal of developing condominiums. That was the original vision. But because of the ups and downs of the Japanese economy, those plans got delayed. And Maui Tomorrow was very involved in slowing down those development plans by insisting on environmental impact statements, because too often the developers will just build and there will be contamination from storm runoff that will destroy beaches and reefs. It suffered from poor restrictions on developers.
Okay, well, let's move on to the Shaka Foundation.
Shaka stands for Sustainable Hawaii Agriculture for Keiki and the Aina.
So, but Shaka also means something in Hawaii.
Shaka is a symbol like hang loose, you know, take it easy.
Right.
That's kind of how the acronym was put together. Keiki are children, and Aina is the life force of the land. So the significance of it was we wanted to treat agriculture, have agriculture treat the environment more sensitively with regard to the impacts on children and the health of the environment. And we've had the mixed blessing of the sugar industry there for many years. And over the last 60 years, like most industrial agriculture, it's become more and more involved with chemicals. They dust the sugar crop with a desiccant to dry it out prior to harvest, and then when they burn in the fields, which is not universally done, but it was has been permitted there for a long time, the cane smoke is not only a nuisance, but those chemicals are airborne and wind up blowing into some of the areas like South Maui, where the wind pattern blows a lot of the smoke. But the other issue was the arrival of Monsanto, who not only on Maui, but on the island of Molokai, which is part of Maui County. And what Hawaii has become is the testing ground, the petri dish for the seed industry to test their chemicals to see which ones are effective, and they're modifying genetically modifying corn to see what traits will be beneficial for their plans. There's a good deal of concern that those traits will get loose in the environment and have an impact that can't be assessed. There is because the chemicals used are so many and so noxious, they're called restrictive use chemicals, that they don't just stay on the ground when they're put in on the crops. When they're sprayed, they blow in the wind. And the neighbors and schools nearby have been impacted by these things. You can smell it, you can taste it, and we know from the study of this these pesticides that they have can have a very harmful effect, especially on young mothers, on pregnant women, on unborn, the unborn, on and on people who are living there who notice that their eyes are stinging, their lungs are smarting, and we feel that we are being abused, and this abuse is then the crop is tested there, and then it goes from there to South America to North America in a whole cycle of planting. So what starts on Maui and in Hawaii is spread around the world.
Which is why this movement should be important to all of us, even those of us here in Oregon and other listeners around the world. Which chemicals are you talking about? Are you talking about the pesticides that like Roundup and things? Are you talking about pesticides? I mean, GMO is engineering plants to be pesticide resistant, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and so these chemicals you're talking about are the pesticide side of it?
Well, there's the general use pesticides, of which Roundup is a general use pesticide, but there are more toxic chemicals that are restricted use pesticides, and we use a great many of them. I couldn't name them all to you. We use up the rest of the time.
But how does that relate
together
to GMO? How does pesticides relate to GMO?
Because they spray massive amounts of these pesticides to kill any possibility that there will be any interference with the trials that are being conducted out there in the fields.
I see.
So we have 700 plus acres on Maui in residential areas, and on Molokai they had 2,300 acres. On the island of Kauai they had 16,000 acres that were right in the pathway of the prevailing winds, blowing the pesticide drift right into the town of and schools of Waimea on the west side of Kauai. And there have been the times when the schools have closed and had to rush students and teachers to the emergency room.
Now, you were speaking about Aina.
It's called Aina.
Aina.
It's the life force of the land.
Okay.
So the land is being killed, and it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop in the soil because the pesticides percolate down into the water table and then out into the ocean. And so it has a pervasive effect.
Right.
And, you know, people should just think about it. The very idea of spraying poisons on food and then turning around and serving it, or putting it in right into the food itself, as they do with the genetic modification of these crops, which are mostly corn. And I think ultimately most of that corn is used as feedstock for livestock.
Now, you explained that Maui is being chosen as a kind of a guinea pig for experimenting and testing these things by Monsanto. That's what they want to do. And I think it's interesting to point out that a big player in Maui and the largest landowner is A&B, a company called A&B. And they were the ones running the sugar plantation. And what is the relationship between Monsanto and A&B? I mean, A&B is where Monsanto got the land, right?
Well, Monsanto actually bought out some existing seed companies. I think DeKalb was one of them. And that's what happened. We didn't really notice how they kind of came in. They didn't announce what they were doing. We just thought, well, there are these seed companies that had been there for many years because of the fact you can get three or four growing seasons in an area where there's not a lot of wind and where there's sunshine most of the time. So Monsanto took over these companies, and it was only when we started noticing the health effects that we began to look into it and kind of see what it is they were going on. And when you asked for disclosure, as they did with an ordinance on the island of Kauai, the companies refused to disclose it. When we asked that they have a buffer zone for planting, they were planting right up to the edge of the schoolyard, in a complete flagrant disregard for the health of the neighbors. They opposed that bill. So they opposed any kind of control or disclosures. But under freedom of information, we were able to find out that they're allowed to use up to 80 different chemicals. And these chemicals are being used in exotic combinations. And these are restricted use pesticides. So the people using them have to wear the equivalent of hazmat suits in order to spray this stuff. And we're putting it down in the environment, and it only takes a short while before the winds lift those pesticides and deposit them 40, 50 miles away.
Now, I think it's interesting to note that A&B, being this large landowner and also having control of the water, which is supposed to be a public resource, but the sugar fields need incredible amount of irrigation, and now the sugar factory and the sugar plantation is being closed down. It's been running at a loss for quite some time. This is the last sugar plantation in Hawaii.
It was never about the sugar as a crop. That was a loss leader. They lost money on sugar, but it gave them control of the water. And Maui Tomorrow has actually been challenging their use of that water. So it's a very long, complex story. And
how did they benefit from controlling the water? Who did they sell it to? How do they?
Well, the A&B, Alexander Bowman, has been the only bidder on leases, four large lease areas, most of which are on public land. And they get the equivalent of 65 billion gallons of water a year for $162,000.
Wow.
If you do the math on that, you'll see they've been getting the equivalent of a $40 million benefit. And that water is a public trust. There's a public trust doctrine in Hawaii that says water is something that should be used for the benefit of not only present population, but for future generations.
Now, it occurred to me many times on many of my visits to Hawaii that beautiful verdant valley, and it's known as the Valley Isle because there's two volcanoes and there's this very fertile valley in between where they've been doing the monoculture with sugar for so long. It seems to me that you could grow all kinds of things. I mean, why wouldn't A&B sell that off for, you know, independent farming? Or is that, I know you have a plan, a future plan for
They're water banking and land banking.
Mm-hmm.
They would like to hang on to the land. We're talking about 40 square miles, something like 35,000 acres. And ultimately the greatest value and where they have made a fortune is in slowly converting the land for residential projects and commercial development. And they seem to have enough influence in the county to be able to get almost every project they propose approved.
But I'm talking about that vast tract of land in the valley, which is really good for residential.
So all that's out there, now that they've closed the mill and sugar is no longer an option, they have a list of crops, of energy crops, that they're going to be using, food crops, energy crops, and cattle, that they hope to use as justification for continuing to get water delivered to them. But in the long run, those are really temporary crops, because they would like to continue to own the land and to have water delivered to them, so that in the future they can transition to residential projects.
I see. Shaka passed a moratorium that would force Monsanto to prove that their chemicals are safe. Tell us about that.
Well, that was our first thing. The original visionaries behind the Shaka movement were a couple of gentlemen, Bruce Douglas and Joe Marcella, who, you know, just as we might, said, hey, this is wrong. Spraying poison like this and allowing some outside company to come in and use us as a petri dish for their testing and then ship out the profits and leave us with the pollution, that's wrong, and we should stop it. So they wrote a petition, an ordinance that basically said that those agricultural practices should be halted while an independent assessment is done proving that there's no harm to the environment or to the people who live around those areas.
Right.
Well, that was considered to be, very offensive by the development community, by Monsanto. We had to go through a petition drive, ultimately getting over 19,000 signatures, half of which were thrown out by the registrar of the county. But we managed to get enough votes to get it on the ballot. And so in 2014, it was on the November ballot, and it passed by 1%. Monsanto spent $8 million trying to convince the people of Maui County that we were going to be banning our agriculture. And in fact, the way the ballot initiative was worded, it emphasized, instead of the protective aspect, it emphasized the punitive aspect of the ordinance. But it passed, and the very next day Monsanto announced that they would be taking the issue to court. And that's a long story that people could go to the Maui GMO Moratorium News.com website and read the whole story. Or they could just look up Shaka Movement, Shaka, and follow the links to this website, and they can get the whole story. But long story short, the federal judge ruled that that's a state authority and the counties can't really pass laws protecting the public health.
But the battle's not over. You're not giving up.
Well, we took it to the next level, which was the appeal court level, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal judges basically agreed with the federal judge that it was not something that counties or cities could enact on their own without, because it was ought to be controlled by the state. And as a result of it, a negative result is now Monsanto and the large industrial agricultural forces, the seed industry, have gone to other states and passed similar laws basically saying that local communities cannot protect the public health, that should be left up to the states. But in any event, the result we got 23,000 people in Maui County to vote for the moratorium. That was in 2014. In 2016, those same interests backed a slate of candidates for county council, with the idea that if the regular council members don't see the danger of using pesticides so extravagantly and aren't interested in dealing with the health issues, maybe we need new people on the county council. So we ran nine candidates for all nine areas, and we wound up getting four of our candidates elected to the council.
Fantastic. Okay, so that's a success story right there.
Absolutely.
Well, what can our listeners do to support your efforts at the Shaka movement?
Well, first of all, people want to get educated to the whole thing. You know, they can just start with a short meditation by thinking, let's see now, putting poison on food, who could benefit from that? On the face of it, it is nuts. But the more people will dig, if people will dig into this issue, there's a couple of issues. One, there's the very issue of genetically modifying food, and what might happen if those traits get loose in the environment.
Okay, so what can they do? They educate themselves.
Then educate themselves. They can go to the website, and they can donate to the Shaka Foundation.
You guys need money,
right? Of course, all of these battles.
These are nonprofits that are fighting a battle for the environment, for the whole world, and you need funding.
Exactly.
Okay, great.
And we've been very successful in getting support from a wide range of people, not only for Shaka. Right now, for example, we're heading toward a study that we're going to be doing. We have funding for it. We need a little more funding for that in order to be able to test people who live downwind to show what health impacts they're experiencing.
You need funding for a lot of things. You're going up against a juggernaut in court. Hey, we've run out of time, and I want to thank you, Mark, for being on the show. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about the websites. They can go to Google and they can do Shaka Movement Maui and find the website, which is MauiGMOMoratoriumNews.com.
And if people want a more personal thing, they can contact me directly, mark@marksheehan.com.
mark@marksheehan.com. Okay, great. Thanks, Mark. And we could explore a lot more, but we're out of time. And for those who tuned in late, this is your Pathways host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview anytime you like, or take it as a free podcast. Today we have been visiting with Mark Sheehan, one of the founders of the Shaka Action Fund for the Environment. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed worldwide via KBOO.fm Sunday mornings at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Mark Sheehan and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways experience.